Right. The last time that we had left off was just before you were coming to California the second time.
Mm-hmm.
And you had told me that you had gone back to work. You had picked dates, was it?
Yes, but then when we left off, I think I was in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, working in the PX.
Right, you'd come
and
back.
And I'd gone back, and all hell broke loose on the 7th of December.
Mm-hmm.
That I was working in officers' post-exchange, or, well, in the post-exchange, but in the officers, they were separated. And the war was declared that day, and just like all of a sudden, everybody went crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, everything went crazy. I was ordered out of the barracks. The family that I went there with, we lived in the barracks,
mm-hmm.
In the civilian section.
Mm-hmm.
And the wife picked up and left, and he was transferred out within 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told to evacuate the barracks and find quarters in town. And I don't know, it was just general confusion. Everybody was leaving to go to Seattle or to California, or I think this lady suggested that I come to California, or I don't remember exactly how, but I did come out here with in those days they had drivers, cars that came back and forth, and they'd take passengers, and you'd pay $10, $15 for your, and would be 4 to 6 in a car. Anyway, that's how I came back out here.
Mm-hmm.
But I had an address to come to in San Pedro. And when I got out here, the joker that I... Oh, first of all, he ran off with my luggage. I paid, I think, $12 to come out here
mm-hmm.
In a car, private car. There were 6 or 7 passengers. We were stacked on top of each other. And they dropped us off downtown. And he was going to go to park the car. And then he was going to come back. And he dropped us off in a hotel downtown somewhere, and we were to wait in the lobby for him. He was going to park the car and then come back, and then each one of us was going to get our luggage. He was going to go park the car. And we waited, and he never came back. So, I don't know, I had $4 or $5, and I took a streetcar to San Pedro. This must have been about a couple of days before Christmas then. I can't remember exactly. I know I stayed in Fort Sill for maybe 2 weeks after the Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went up to Oklahoma City. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to Oklahoma City to see my mother. And then from there I pick a newspaper, pick the ad out of the paper, call the guy, I want to go to California. That's how I got out here.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow that dropped us off, we'd paid in advance, he disappeared. Luggage and all. So here I am, I have a coat, and my clothes on my back, and my purse, and a coat.
Well,
and that was it. I mean, he took my luggage, he took my pictures, he took everything. Oh, you know, the little souvenirs a young girl has. And I went to San Pedro, went to the address that I had, and the person that I went to see, the fellow, was off, gone, service. So there I was. And I guess I had a lot of help in those days because every place I would turn, you know, someone was there to help me. Maybe my youth, I don't know what it was. But I came back to Hollywood, got a room,
mm-hmm.
then began my landlady shifted me from room to room to room in the same hotel, Studio City Hotel, for a little place in Hollywood. But you could only stay in a hotel for X amount of days, and then you had to move. This was a wartime thing.
Mm-hmm.
So she'd put me on the first floor, and then I'd go to the second floor, then she'd put me on the third floor, and I'd re-register each time.
Oh.
And, well, that's my first early memory of being totally and completely alone in California, and I settled in Hollywood.
Had just the trip-picking dates made you decide that you wanted to be back here? Or?
Well, yes, because when we were working in India, we came into the city a couple of times. We'd come into Hollywood, real tourists. And I liked the weather, and I thought, well, actually, how I decided to come here the second time after Fort Sill, as I said, there was such mass confusion down there. Here we'd been working, all of a sudden everything, the post was closed to every civilian, and all this, all the rigmarole of you had to have a birth certificate to come on the post, you had to have government permits, and the lady that I worked with worked on the post as a civilian, and I worked in the PX. And I'm still not, I still can't figure out what happened to her. All of a sudden, she packed up and she was gone. Her husband was transferred. He was in the service, mm-hmm. on the post, as a soldier. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember what happened to her. I think she went to Seattle, or she got a job in a shipyard or something, and suddenly she was gone, just like that. But I had been, when we were picking dates in Indio, and with that family, we'd come into Hollywood a couple of times, and it just seemed the logical place for me. Mm-hmm. So my second day here, I got a job in bowling alley. We had a huge, tremendous bowling alley, 52 lanes, and I couldn't find, you know, I didn't know what to do. I had no experience. I was underage, so I walked into the bowling alley, and I got a job as a pin setter. I think I stayed 2 days. It was too noisy. And then I went to work for Krieger Oil Company. Now, this is the end of December, the beginning of January, I guess, 42, January, February. Mm-hmm. And everywhere you looked, signs, help wanted, help wanted, help wanted. I was going crazy in my mind. And yet, because of my age, so I started lying about my age immediately. I became 18 suddenly. Overnight, I suddenly became 18 years old.
And you were actually about 16 or 17?
I think I was 16. Mm-hmm. When I actually totally on my own here without, I didn't know a soul. Just the first person I ever really got to know here was my landlady at the studio hotel. And she, I guess, felt sorry for me because I could stay a week and then she'd have to move me to another room, and then I'd re-register, and each time changing my initials or something, because there was some sort of a restriction then on, and it was impossible to find a place to live. Mm-hmm. We lived, I suppose like the Mexicans do today, we doubled up 4 or 5 to an apartment. You know, in an apartment like this, there would be 6 or 7 people living. Mm-hmm. Although in those days you worked and came home only to sleep and get up and go back to work. But I would say by April or May, there was just jobs everywhere, signs everywhere. The only thing is you couldn't find a place to live. And I always managed, though. I was lucky. I'd go look for a room, and the first thing they would ask me is, do you have food coupons? And I had a friend. I met a girl, and she had a car. And she had gas ration coupons. And she later went into the service, and they left her car with me and her gas ration coupons. The car I used maybe 3 months. I didn't have a driver's license. And our tires went, and that was the end of the car. But I still had the gas coupon license. So I had two sets of... Now, this is kind of funny, but I applied for food rations myself, for myself. My father automatically was sent food rations for all of us because I was still 16 years old. My mother got food coupon books listing each child. And my dad sent me my books. Mm-hmm. He very faithfully mailed those books to me in the mail, and I would get them here. So I had two sets of food coupon rations. This was the best friendship buyer. I bought friendship. I bought everything. I got rooms. And the minute I would go for a room, the first thing they would say is, do you have any... Well, you have a shoe. Oh, you work in aircraft. Okay, listen, you have extra rations. You have extra shoe coupons. So we had to have rations, a stamp for shoes, too.
Uh-huh.
This is getting on in now into the middle, late 42 and 43.
Uh-huh.
But I actually, you might say, was able to bargain. I had two sets of food coupon rations, and I'd give them my sugar and my butter coupons and exchange for my coffee in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we had to have rations to buy food.
So you did a lot of bartering.
Well, I was able to get a place to live most of the time,
mm-hmm.
a room, One lady, Mrs. Hall, I lived in her parlor, as she called it, her parlor. She set up a day bed in the parlor for me. And I don't know how much she charged me, but it did seem to be a lot at that time, considering that when I first came here, my first job, I was working for $16 a week. And within 3 months, I think I was making $45 a week, which is more than money than I ever saw in my entire life. I didn't even know what to do with it. I might also add, though, my dear, one thing that when I first hit here in the end of, or just before Christmas of 41, I didn't have any money. My luggage had been stolen. I had no clothes. I just had what I had on my back and a coat. And I had the coat on me because it was, I brought the coat from where I needed it when I left there because it was colder than hell when I left Oklahoma in December of 41. And when I got to California, gee, it was so nice and warm, we all threw off our coats. But I still had my coat in my lap in the car and my purse. And the guy at the city dropped us off in front of some rat flea-bitten hotel downtown. We didn't know the difference because it was just a bunch of kids like myself that came out here. And he was going to park the car in the hotel, and he was going to come back, and then we would all go and get our luggage. And he disappeared. So lucky for me, I had my coat. But I had just maybe $2 or $3 in my purse. I don't even think I had that much, to tell you the truth. But I did. I sent my dad a telegram, and I told him, I'm in California, and I'm going to get a job, and I don't have any money. And it's the first time in my life I ever asked him for anything. And he sent me a blank check, and I think I wrote a check for $7. My landlady accepted it, and that was my week's rent. And I thought, God, that's a lot of money for rent. But it's a hotel, and I have maid service, so at least till I get a place to work. And she accepted it without question. She just took it. But she, you know, must have known that I was honest, because I told her what happened to me. And he sent me another check about a week later, a blank check again. And he kept doing this for about, 3 months. And even after I'd left the studio hotel, the landlady would call me. I told her where I was going. And she'd say, you have a letter here from Texas. And my dad kept sending blank checks for about, 3 months, until I wrote and told him I don't need money anymore. And, maybe a year later, I sent him a couple of $100. I wired it to him through the sheriff. And he said that they had an awful lot of trouble with the sheriff when they brought the money out to him, that he wanted to know where he was getting that money and who it was coming from. And, you know, but I mean, I sent him a wire, a Western Union money order, and the sheriff had to take it out to him. So that is one memory I have of him, you see. Although I never asked him for anything before or after that ever again, but I never forgot that. So that's how I really got started here in that first crucial 2 weeks that I was here. And then for food, I went to the thrifty drugstore, and I got a grilled cheese sandwich and a Coke for a dime, or an egg salad sandwich and a Coke, and I lived on one meal a day for possibly a week that I was here. So that's... Then... how was I recruited for Lockheed? There were signs everywhere for work. I worked in a gas station.
Now, you said that you'd gone from the bowling alley to the...
Krieger Oil Company as working in a gas station. No, first I went to Mueller Brothers, I think it was, on Sunset Boulevard. There was a huge, from the bowling alley, which was huge, I went to, it's now Mark C. Bloom. At that time it was something else. And it was a gas station, and they had a comic outside, and they had a black comedian who greeted everyone. It was a gimmick. And then I was hired to work to pump gas. Mm-hmm. And but they didn't want to pay me very much money. They were paying me, I think, the bowling alley was working for tips, setting up pins. But I couldn't take that. It was too noisy. Krieger, the first gas station I worked was paying me $16 a week. Mm-hmm. Then someone came into the gas station and recruited me, or said, look, we'd like to have you. How much are you making here? And I said, they said, we'll give you 18. Come to work for us. And this was Krieger Oil Company. And I worked with them for a couple of months, and every day, I mean, everybody was coming, you need a job, you want a job, you want a job. My head was going crazy. They were recruiting workers for any kind of work you wanted to do. You could get a job, anything you wanted to do. They would come to me. And as far as Lockheed is concerned, or Vega is the first company, someone came in 2 or 3 times to the station, and they asked me, you know, how old are you? I'm 18. I was given 3 or 4 times the same person came in to get me to come to work, or to get me to come out to the application office. And I didn't even know where it was. I still, today I could find it probably if it were still there. But one day I said, okay, I'm off tomorrow. I'll go and fill out papers. But I called this girl that I'd met, and she and I went together. And we both got a job at the same time. And she was just, I think, 18 at the time. And I didn't even have to go for the job. People were coming to me for jobs. And not only just me, but everyone. They were recruiting workers, and they didn't care whether you were black, white, young, old. They didn't really care if you could work. This is now, it even got worse in 43. Mm-hmm. But 42, the people were coming out here from everywhere, and it became suddenly overcrowded. Even where you worked, somebody would come up to you and say, listen, I can get you a better job. Listen, I can get you more money. Listen, do you want to do a little extra work? I worked 2 jobs for a long time. I had so much work offered to me, and I wasn't not even qualified. I really just had a capability of learning very fast, because at the same time I worked in aircraft, I worked also for a record cutting company. I was a photographer. I used to take pictures for one of those servicemen's, it was a studio where we took pictures and we cut records and made tape recordings for the servicemen, and they would send them back home. Uh-huh. I had so much work, sometimes I wouldn't even go back for my money. And sometimes I'd get a check, they'd mail me a check, and I'd say, Gina, wait a minute, where was this? And at one period of time, I had 6 or 8 checks laying in my, dresser drawer that I hadn't even cashed. I just simply didn't know how to handle money. I didn't know what to do with it all. You couldn't buy anything, except, of course, I lined up for my cigarettes. That was the one compulsion that I had. I had to get those cigarettes. There again, once a week, and as an aircraft worker, we were... certain places we could go once a week and get a carton of cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And there were certain places you could go to get extra gallon of gas without the A coupon. I had A coupons. Mm-hmm. And the only way I got those was when Edna went into the Navy. Mm-hmm. She and I worked in aircraft, but she and I worked in a different department. We both went for the same job, but she was immediately hired for a more educated job because she had finished high school. I went on the assembly line, and she went on into a specialized department. So that was the end of our working together, although our plans had been that we would go back and forth to... Oh, and we also got an apartment because we worked in aircraft. We had priority, and there was a place where you could go and apply for a place to live. And if you had top priority, which you had when you worked in aircraft, you could go on the list for the first available apartment. So we... I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to look for a job. But before that, before the war, and in Oklahoma City and in California, even when the first time I came, when we'd come down here, mm-hmm. I'd ask people if I could get a job, and they'd say, "Well, you're not old enough," Mm-hmm. And in Oklahoma, I had a hell of a time getting a job. Mm-hmm. Oh, crummy, I had a hard time. I was as still 13, 14, 15, but I couldn't get a job. Yeah. So.
Now, again, you mentioned earlier, how did you, as far as the job got lucky, was it someone else telling you to come out and apply?
No, sweetheart, they had signs everywhere you would look. Mm-hmm. All the newspapers just flashed everywhere. Help wanted, jobs, jobs, jobs. Pick up a newspaper, jobs. Mm-hmm. propaganda on the radio. We didn't have television then. Every radio station, if you're an American citizen, if you have a birth certificate, come to gate so-and-so at Lockheed, or so-and-so at the shipyards, or so-and-so at San Pedro. You were bombarded, just as today you're bombarded by commercials on radio and television. They were begging for workers. So now we can really get right into Vega.
Was that your next job after the gas station?
Well, the bowling alley was first because I'm here 2 days, and I have no money. I think, like I said, I had a dollar or two. The landlady, where the studio hotel, I explained to her that I had just come out here, that I was expecting money. I lied to her a lot. I said, my father's going to send me a check, or my mother's going to send me a money order, and she took me. Mm-hmm. She was a nice old lady. Mm-hmm. She was really nice. And the first job was the bowling alley, help wanted, pin setters, you know, but I hung in there because they had a special on food where you could go and get all you wanted to eat for 15, 20 cents. And so I said, okay, I'll work. First I asked for a job serving beer or serving the lines, and they said, well, you got to be 18 or you got to be 21 to serve alcohol. So I set up pins for 2 days. Well, from that I met a couple of people, and one I met at the gas station. One of the fellows that worked at the gas station, he said, my God, he said, they're crying for help over there. Come on over and get a job. So walked over there, and I said, I'm interested in working. And they said, you ever pumped gas before? And I said, no, but I can learn. And 15 minutes later, I was out there working and filling tanks with gas. And, you know, I had no experience. Mm-hmm. I learned as I went along. That was the second job. The third job was the Krieger Oil Company, which was better because they gave me a uniform every day and soap to wash the grease off my hands. And they taught me how to, you know, do battery. But there weren't that many cars then. You had to have a gas coupon. You were limited to a certain amount of gas. It was very simple, very easy. You know, check the oil, wipe the windshield, put the gas in, get the money, get the coupon, go. And from that, I went to Vega. Mm-hmm. Vega, I went out in the morning, and I went to the interview or unemployment office, and they said, do you have a birth certificate? And I said, no, but I can get one. And they hired me for the, I went ahead and started to work without the birth certificate. I wrote my dad again for that. Mm-hmm. And I got it within about 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. I don't think they really doubted that I was born in this country, let's put it that way. And I went the first, as a matter of fact, I think I went in the very next day to work. And I started in on a bench. They had a long bench.
Now, this was in like the spring of 42?
April, May of 42, mm-hmm. when they were just recruiting the women workers. The first thing I noticed when I went in there, though, that there were, all the men were instructors. Most of the men were workers. I mean, I saw very few women. And even the bench that I worked on, there were six or eight young boys, 18, 19 years old, myself, and there were two or three elderly or middle-aged women, not elderly. To me, they were elderly, but now I would say they were in their late 30s or 40s. And it was very dull and very boring. And the first day I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. I have to sit here for 3 weeks on this bench. What we did was we learned to buck and then we learned to rivet. One would, and you didn't really use the tools or anything. You just became familiar with the little metal, I can't remember now, pellet. And I sat there for 3 or 4 hours that first day, and I picked up the rivet gun, and I showed him, well, I mean, this is easy. You show me once, I'll do it for you. And the bucking, you have a bar. And I said, what's to learn here? I mean, look at my hands. They're full of grease. I've been working as a grease monkey. I mean, you know, this is silly. I could do this. I don't have to sit here and train. I think I did have to stay on that bench for 2 days. And
this was almost like it was just for instruction. It was a whole training area.
It was a training area, although we could see. First of all, this let me see if I can describe my first impression, or it, which later was truth. It was like you were walking into a big, huge, cavernous barn, high, white, dead white, from lights, huge, tremendous lights. In fact, I think it's probably the lights that made it so hot. But just like a huge hangar, and in on platforms, or on sawjacks, as I would call them, but actually they were platforms, they had hulls and shells and pieces and parts of planes. Now, I went into assembly, so this was the first. Later, when I went into final assembly, it became a whole new picnic altogether. But my first day, which was maybe the second or third day that I went to work there, I went from this long bench where they had a half of a shell of the belly. I can't remember the actually what it would be called, but like the rib cage of the plane, B-17s, the department I was in. I can remember the department number, but that's all I can remember. I can't tell you where it was, or it was 16. But the first day, as I said, we sat on this bench, and we just, and then, you know, I said, well, this, I mean, I never stay on this job. I mean, this is really, it's too easy. But I went into the shell the next day, and I went inside and I bucked, and then I went outside and I riveted. And now this is on the actual part. I had men. I was working with real seasoned, workable men, and it was so easy. I mean, we did strips. By strip, it means the whole hull. They used me on the inside. When we were on the lower section, I riveted. When we got to the middle section, I went inside to buck. We used strips of, like, cheesecloth and some kind of a green chemical paste. This chemical green cheesecloth and paste had to go on the inside and across the seam, and that, I had to do that, and then I had to put the strip, and then as the riveter outside riveted, I was inside bucking. And you just, it would be like, sort of like a sewing machine. You just have to keep, go along with them. And I think I stayed there maybe 6 weeks, and I worked on all parts of it up in the wings, and one by one, day by day, new faces, every day. And I said, well, where are all the men going off to war? I would say within 6 months, there were maybe 20 or 30 men left in Department 16, where maybe there had been 1,500 when I first went there. And then gradually it began to be replaced by women and blacks. Now, I'm not knocking the blacks, because if there's any race in the United States that I really feel sorry for, it's the blacks. And I was brought up in a little town where the only black I'd ever seen was a porter on a train. And so I never really, I had a fear instilled in me of the blacks, only because they were a different race. But I never really had any, we had no racial prejudice in Childress, because we didn't have any blacks, just the train and the porters coming through. And there might have been one or two black families living across the tracks who did the train work, porters, you know, cleaning and things. But when the blacks started coming in, suddenly I was jerked off my nice little wing section and off my belly section.